Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Good evening, Francis. I'm good. I'm good. Thank you very much.
Good to have you back on the show, the Reset Podcast. We have Michael Ingram, very well received. We actually had parts one, two, and three. We thought we'd do 20 minutes. We did over an hour and 20. With so much to get into. Lots of qualitative information came out last time. And for you, this time, this is what I'm going to kick off with Mike. My hypothesis, and I've since seen a gentleman, Jim Rickards, quite well known in the gold front. He talks of a Shanghai Accord. Basically, the G20, that was the end of February 26 and 27. We know how we came into this year. And in fact, those that had a look at the World Finance clip that I did in November, I said, China fears you can't rebottle that very easily. We're going to go into the new year on big sell-offs. That transpired. But what we didn't factor on was what would come out of the G20. G20, 26th and 27th of February, after the worst 2 months for equities in I don't know how many years. And there was, many of them went in, Mike. I don't know if you remember, saying, "Wow, this is real serious issue, real big problems." And we all expected a bit of a press conference when they came out, saying, "Wow, this is what we're going to do." And they all came out and had nothing to declare and said, "What problem? No problem. There's no problem. Carry on and keep on and carry on." And that left me with the lingering suspicion that agreement had been met behind closed doors and that we were not party to that agreement. And shortly after, it was the Fed FOMC statement. And that, Mike, is when you reminded me in our preamble that we went from four rate hikes dot plot to two, a 50% reduction in the first 3 months of the year when they came into January being exceedingly bullish. Isn't that incredible of itself, Mike?
Yeah, it was a complete capitulation, and it came to the background of an incoming FOMC that was significantly more hawkish than the one that we had during the course of 2015. So I think there was an agreement to get the dollar down and flattening the trajectory of Fed rate hikes was instrumental in engineering that, because we were at the point of seeing a disorderly market. And the question actually now I'm asking is, well, what was the quid pro quo for that deal? Okay, we got the Fed says, do you know what? It's not in our interest to see the whole rest, the rest of the global economy burn. We'll get our interest rates down. We'll get our currency down. But what would we be expecting to see from the other side of the equation?
Well, if I can jump in there,
yeah,
to put some also to sketch the scene and some of the detail, because I know you're going to take us someplace interesting. Let's remember, China essentially had at that juncture a de facto floor stroke peg system with the dollar, and I know you've got some comment on the structure of that and how it's morphed somewhat since, but yeah. We also have to remember we came into this year after 2.5 years. That's mid-July the 14th 2014, my apologies, that oil began its big capitulation of the better part of 2 years, and the Saudi peg and many assets. I've got Scandinavian clients that have been telling me the Saudis have been dumping everything of their investments in Scandinavia, turning cash. The great oil bite is happening, and every time they've been the swing producers, you've also pointed out in our previous discussion, in other words, everyone else is pumping max and China just tops up the rest to global demand. If everyone else is maxing out, they don't get to make the same level of volume, never mind the fact it's fetching a whole bunch of lower price. So they've been squeaking as well. So that just kind of sets the precariousness that both China was in and in Saudi, and also to a smaller degree the emergings, which are not necessarily all as friendly allies of the US, but some of them may be. The emergings that have been taken strain, a lot of our big, those that follow me technically, a lot of our macro Mexican peso and rand huge monthly HVFs had made target. So we actually set the scene for a bit of manipulation potentially, and they didn't let us down, Mike. What's your take on the relevance of who needed the help as well and their FX type relationship to the dollar?
Well, I think that just to say where we are right now, I think we're in a highly unstable equilibrium, and as much as risk assets have come back, I mean, the current situation isn't sustainable. Broad brush, a strong dollar is bad for emerging markets. And it was pretty mechanistically bad for China, which was operated until the end of November last year on a dollar peg. Obviously, they'd introduced over the years a little bit more flexibility around that, a bit more volatility, a bit more on the crawl. But it was still essentially a dollar peg. Now, going through December into the new year, the situation you actually saw was quite interesting, and people still talking even today. I was talking to a journalist about this, about the stability of the Chinese yuan. It is not stable. It is not stable. It's only stable against what is now a very weak dollar. I mean, the dollar index is pretty much at a 12-month low. So what the People's Bank of China have been doing over the last 5 months now has been depreciation against this basket of currencies, this nominal effective exchange rate. And I would imagine that the Fed, the Shanghai consensus would have been that the China stops doing that. Unfortunately, they haven't stopped doing that. Also,
if I can interject there, it might be worthwhile for just for those that are slightly less FX orientated and aren't looking at the markets and are listening to us for the economic side and the reset side. What we've seen is since both the Fed statements is the relative appreciation on a huge level for the yen, which we called the reversal on the USD JPY technically a while back, and more of interest to many, the euro having to wear some of the relative strength. As Reichard always says, and it's important to understand with FX, they trade in pairs. For one to go down means it's going down relative to others. That means they are going up. And the main non-beneficiaries of the appreciation, given that everyone wishes to trash, was the euro and the yen.
Yeah.
So, sorry, Mike, carry on there, but just to give that context for everybody.
Well, it was double whammy for the yen, because not only is the interest rate differential between, say, the US dollar and the yen also narrowing, so this so-called divergent trade, you know, where the Federal Reserve just merely keeps on hiking rates and everybody else, you know, the ECB and the BOJ, et cetera, just continue to cut. There are clearly limits to the extent that can be prosecuted, yeah, both in terms of the underlying economics, but also, of course, you know, the sort of divergence that you would otherwise see in the currency starts to become a political issue. So I think there's that overlay to consider, and at the same time, you know, Japan was not only in a situation where it was actually not standing up quite so badly against the dollar in terms of prospective yield, but it's also a safe haven currency. So it also had flows associated with that as well. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen this massive move in dollar yen. And to some extent, the ECB has also had the backwash from that. I mean, for me, you know, coming out of this Shanghai consensus was not only that the Federal Reserve doesn't raise as much, but nobody else cuts, everybody else doesn't cut as much either. So the BOJ, you'd say, well, after the fiasco of negative interest rates end of January, well, they might have had pause for thought anyway. I think part of the reason they had problems was it's clear they didn't consult anywhere near enough with the banking system before introducing that. But also the ECB didn't ease by as much as expected. And for me, this is very much...
If I can add again, jumping in, is that one of the things that was most noteworthy and that other commentators have highlighted and that I did note as well, is that Draghi, in his statement, while he largely delivered what people expected in terms of the QE, etc., he also said, and that's it. We aren't doing any more.
I mean, I think it wasn't quite as definitive that, but he certainly said that the emphasis on monetary easing going forward, if it was needed, was going to be on asset purchases, QE, rather than delving ever deeper into negative interest rates. And, you know, I've always taken the view that negative rates is really a capital control dressed up as a monetary policy move. The primary aim of negative interest rates is to get the currency down. But as I said, on the BOJ, that backfired magnificently. But what I was about to say is that for me, where we were in sort of March, April period was very much a reprise of where we were in sort of November, early December last year, when again you saw a host of G10 central banks not ease by as much as expected, which settled markets down, post the Chinese shock, and allowed risk assets to rally into year end.
Do you think they stepping back a little from the whole negative rates? There was a time when everyone was counting how many countries had gone negative and saying it's just a matter of time before everybody is negative and the US and all of that. There was a bit of a NERP fascination that everyone once again took everything to the extremes. Do you get a feeling that there's been words have been said behind doors and there's a little bit of pedal back? Yes, they
yes,
already
definitely.
Are those that exist, but there's no greater enthusiasm to go deeper down that rabbit hole.
Definitely. No doubt in my mind that that's what's happened. And of course, central bankers will say, well, we do recognize that it can have, negative connotations for the profitability of the banking sector. It might mean that there's actually less credit created.
Well, you may know that I'm out there saying Deutsche Bank is a bust. I won't be the only one, though. But I'm also called technically such. And there are views that suggest that if they want a full-blown German banking crisis with the most prominent bank, the NERP rate policy was the perfect way to achieve that in a double quick time. And I wonder if they're having to be made aware of the cause and effect sensitivities of certain policy measures on derivative exposures, especially for particular institutions. And I wonder if that played a part in that.
Yeah, well, you probably understand. I won't comment on specific banks. What I would say is that the policy being prosecuted by central banks is it's something that stops financial institutions from dying, but it keeps them in the intensive care ward. If you consider that, say, the profitability of the European banking sector overall last year was about a 4.5% return on equity, that's about the same level as the dividend that investors are expecting from the banking sector. And so there's no way you're going to grow your asset base at the same time you're going to grow your equity base. I mean, one of the reasons, we had HSBC numbers out.
But what's the reason behind that? Are we tying that into current interest rate policy, or is that just generally? Because there's a lot of bad debts kicking around in Spain, and write-offs and all of that. What's the reason?
Well, I mean, if you think about the basic bread and butter business of banks is to borrow short and lend long. So you have there's a maturity mismatch. And there's a liquidity mismatch, and that's how banks effectively historically made their money. Now the problem is if you keep interest rates low and potentially negative at the short end, and you keep and with forward guidance and so on and so forth, you keep the yield curve flat, then the profits you make by borrowing short and lending long are depressed. And at the same time, you've got regulators increasing the amount of capital that banks have to carry. Increasing the costs of banks and monitoring and compliance and IT and legal and risk and all these things. So, you've got all these fixed costs being layered on top of it. And then, of course, you're in an environment where, growth is feeble, volume growth is feeble. Capital markets may be shaky. They certainly.
Is there a reduced consumer appetite for debt, or is it a case of the bank's criteria are such that they view the consumer in such a way that their lending criteria only whip the cream? In other words, only those that have it get it.
I think
what's restricting the borrowing from the consumer side? I'm particularly interested in that, and I think our listeners will be interested in that. Where's the masses standing on the access to capital thing?
Yeah, I think it depends where you look. I mean, I think that supply of credit to SMEs has been
property is the big safe house, if you'll excuse the pun. And the prime property is unraveling a bit in London at the moment. The super prime and the prime is a bit unraveling. Many saying, if you buy a 7-bar house now, you pay a mil in tax nowadays with all the taxes they levied on the mansions, essentially. And that's starting to affect the market. Many of the oligarchs have already got their London homes, and there's a clear void of any new money that's wanting to jump in and pay those kind of tax levels. And you always fray at the fringes first, don't you? The top end, the extreme top end, then prime, and the bottom end where the workers aren't getting jobs anymore. So are we early doors seeing a lack of enthusiasm from the banks to drive the property valuations any higher, because they do de facto drive them higher by their lending criteria? So are they tightening lending criteria because they're already re-nerved up about the current property price levels?
Again, there's a few things here. So if we take it back to the immediate post-financial crisis, the main thrust of policy has been to de-risk banks because, no government wants to be responsible for
theoretically, Mike.
Theoretically. I think what you're seeing at the moment is the stability of the grave, quite frankly. But there you go. But in that environment, you can understand that banks are going to go for collateralized lending. So anything with collateral is good from a risk perspective, and anything which is unsecured is bad. And unfortunately, that means that supply of credit to SMEs, which of course ultimately is a big driver for innovation, for employment, for productivity growth, etc., gets curtailed. Because
SMEs, this was a discussion we were looking to have as a topic in its own right, but SMEs, banks don't do. Just don't do lending to SMEs on any significant scale. They do borrow. They've become large, bloated home funding, property funding vehicles, and checkbook and savings account providers. They just don't do capital provision for people that are value creators on the basis that it's just deemed too high a risk, too fragmented and too small. You just go to your huge corporate client and drop another million on their overdraft rather than approving 100 or 1,000 clients for $10,000 or £1,000 capital for an SME, don't you?
Well, the other element, I think you're quite right, Francis, but the other element is that it's very difficult also to automate. You know, if you've got a credit card market, there are a lot of data points out there. You can model it and you can price risk, all along the curve. If you've got large corporates, there's a lot of publicly available information out there in which to make a risk assessment, and you've probably got instruments out there trading, so you've got a market valuation of risk as well. SMEs, you know, you've got to actually go out and talk to the people who are running the company. You know, the way that sort of relationship banking, the way it used to work,
and they just don't do that anymore. I mean, shouldn't we get to the point where we just admit that for new venture, banks are just not a feasible, not in the formal sense of applying on it. I mean, there's countless entrepreneurs that have started companies on the back of their credit cards, 3 or 4 on interest-free rates, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of formal provision, acknowledged provision of new venture or early startup or even going for a year or two capital, banks just aren't significant anymore. Businesses have to be self-sustaining or angel-invested, and banks make a small part of that. Or people use the mortgage, the credit card, or the personal loan to start businesses in, and it's securitized in different ways.
Well, I mean, we're getting to dangerous territory, but I went to the Bank of England Open Forum in November last year. And a very interesting day, and I think they're going to do it again this year, and it's done by public ballot. So I think if your listeners see that advertised, it's well worth going. It was actually an interesting day. You normally see an agenda and you think, oh, this looks interesting, but actually it turns out to be boring. You normally sneak off after the buffet at lunchtime. I actually stayed the whole day and ended up having a beer with Mark Carney down in the crypt of the Guildhall. Anyway. What was quite interesting is the view of many there within the Bank of England hierarchy saying that the provision of credit is a public good, and actually the provision of liquidity was a public good. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, if that's the case, then short of talking about the privatization of renationalization, should I say, of the entire banking system, why don't you just define banks relatively narrowly in terms of their types of lending activity, and ring fence it with the payment system, and run them and regulate them like utilities, instead of trying to get them to
master of all trades, attempting to be master of all trades, but actually a jack of all trades.
Well, I think the problem is that, if you have unrealistic, profitability targets, then you end up cutting out the stuff which is difficult.
Bringing it back to looking forward, Mike, because yes, we'll have a day and a half to just sorting out how SMEs get into capital. Yes. But it was one worth tiptoeing on and giving a small touch.
Yes.
My underlying suspicion is that they're precariously treading on eggshells, trying to avoid the next banking crisis that seems very precariously set and could happen at any time. Whether through Europe, you don't have to comment on banks if you're not comfortable, but I've highlighted certain candidates that I think I can include Barclays in that on the UK side, mainly for technical reasons. And then they've been justified with follow-up news, and they've been often the key ones. We had a major sell-off in the banks at the same time, up to the same China Accord that we kicked up talking about. Since the China Accord, that spill, that natural spill, that fear seems to not gone away entirely, but the total capitulative nature of it seems to have been put a little bit on ice. In fact, I'm searching for a browser now just to get the latest price on Barclays and Deutsche Bank just to get us up to current. But I would say... was there not also an element that a banking play was being saved as well by this Shanghai Accord? Everyone's talking about, yes, we needed to save China and to maybe a smaller but still significant degree, the squeezed Arabs that are allies, certainly to America, that there was also a potential banking fail that needed the rebottling.
Yeah, I mean, the market clearly thought they'd identified the next, Lehman moment, and banks such as Credit Suisse, I think, were trading at one point at, I think, a 32-year low. And looking at this, again, not just to try and single out any particular bank, but if you look at the performance of European banks post-financial crisis, they actually peaked in October 2009. Yeah, they've never reattained those heights of 6.5 years ago, which I think is shocking.
Except for Standard Chartered, who was sailing on the China narrative. They hit the merry highs of 2011. You're quite right. All the others lagged thereafter, so the whole recovery narrative for them was a lot more abrupt. But Chartered quickly caught up with the other banks on the downstroke, let's say. So,
well, yeah, this is basically a decoupling thesis of emerging markets decoupling from developed. And now, more recently, post China deval last year, that developed markets are going to decouple from EM. The whole thing of EM from DM, DM from EM is just rubbish. It doesn't happen. We are in a multipolar world. We're in an integrated world, and we all thrive or die together, unfortunately. So there's that. Just going back to what you were saying, I think my summary was that policymakers basically have destroyed the core profitability of the banking system. They've crushed interest rate margins, they've killed off demand for credit, they've loaded more costs on the banking system, and then of course you've got disruptive technology, fintech, etc., coming in and undercutting them in all sorts of areas. Particularly, I point out, in some countries which people such as HSBC, banks such as HSBC, are looking to move into to find a growth market. I mean, China is way ahead of everybody else in the world on fintech. That these banks have to innovate to fill that space, because otherwise it's very clear that other players are going to do it for them. In terms of bailing out banks with low interest rates, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because on one side you want to have a yield curve. You'd actually like to have a slope to your yield curve, because that brings the whole borrow short, lend long thing actually becomes more economically viable. And people have been saying we're looking forward to
a growth market and an expanding liquidity market as well.
Yeah. The problem with that, of course, is if you've got a lot of assets, i.e. loans on your balance sheet, which are only performing it from an accounting sense because interest rates are too low, i.e. the asset quality is very low, then of course you can have anything else in a situation where, yes, in theory you're making more interest rate margin, but your non-performing loans soars. And this
and
is
that I think you that right there is the crux.
Yes.
How many UK consumers right now, how many US consumers right now, if they had to pay what we consider normal prime rate, so if the normal prime rate or Bank of England rate was 5 or 6%, and the banks had their usual 2% margin on that, or 1.5% margin if you're a, you know, super prime gold card Mr. Safe Risk, how many would be able to afford their properties and would be still going on the odd holiday if they were facing an overall percentage of 7% plus, instead of what many are paying in the 2.5, 1.5 range, purely because of this extreme measure. And absolutely, I would imagine the entire asset class would become incredibly unstable, that of homes, which is the last asset that becomes unstable. The last thing you don't pay is the mortgage. You drop the gym fee, you drop the car, you get rid of the HP on this and that and everything. That by the time people stop paying the mortgages, that, I mean, that is pipsqueaking moment of the epic degree. And you're so right on that sole point. I mean, I think you could face 20% plus needing turning out of their homes, and it would be a social crisis where you'd have people in the streets.
Yeah, the problem is because it's systemic. That, you know, you just have this vortex selling that potentially can kick in. But I mean, the more general point I was make is that, you know, for all the talk of, you know, deleveraging post-crisis, global economy hasn't deleveraged at all. Quite the opposite.
It's leveraged up.
Higher dollars, actually, because I think that the Fed ultimately has just enabled the you know, another leg in the misinvestment, the malinvestment that we normally associate with, you know, China and sectors such as, you know, resources.
So it's zombie finances and zero rates forever and a day until either a crisis is enforced on us, even at the zero rates levels, or they decide, and I say they, inverted commas, the system controllers allow the reset to take place. I mean, this is the reset. This is the crux of this podcast, Mike, right flipping here. I mean, this is the reset phoenix, and this is the key element. The banks can't be allowed to have an increasing interest rate cycle because too many of the loans, they already have underperforming loans. I know Eurobanks that have got people handing back the keys on their homes still today. Spain, Portugal, now they've been trying to keep it going. They've squeaked, they've handed them over. You know, it's happening across Europe and even still in certain parts of the UK. If we have the rate hikes that we need to return to a normal balanced supply and demand pricing of debt, too many people get turned out, but no new lending business is occurring. So we not to ordinary people, the 99%, certainly not for business, and certainly not at the low rates. They might do you a credit card at 29.9% APR for a grand here or there, or 5 grand depending on your salary, or 10 grand. But the key element is that the big lending is not happening, even on homes now, because they can't keep digging deeper into this hole where they know there's no way out. And too much of their loan book would just go bad on them if we went back to a normal loan rate. Yes, they'd get profitability on that which they retained, but they would have wholesale write-offs. The profitability on performing loans versus having to just write off an entire £250,000 on a property that's never going to get paid back. I mean, you can't afford to carry too many write-offs.
Yeah, we've created a sort of a zombification of the capitalist system, and you know, we shouldn't be surprised that the zombification of the real economy follows on from that. What we needed, and this is not me being hopefully smart with the benefit of hindsight, is that we needed a bit of creative destruction in the post crisis years, but instead we largely because politicians left the field Very early in the day, they just handed the whole job over to central banks and monetary policy, which, if you think about it in another way, is utterly crazy. Yeah? You have a banking crisis, and then you rely on, almost entirely on monetary policy to actually deflate the economy. What they, of course, were hoping is the real economy picks up to the extent that they didn't have to make these write-ups. You've basically inflated or reflated your way out of trouble. The problem is it hasn't happened. It did look, for me, the pivotal year was 2014, because 2014 was the year, and I'm sure you remember, it was like, we were going to see the steepening yield curve in the US, and, we're going to see interest rates pick up and inflation pick up and blah, 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 blah. Actually, the reverse happened. Yield curve flattened, and, growth rates came off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been fighting a rearguard action on the real economy ever since. I mean, the IMF is expecting an acceleration from what was a very weak growth outturn of about 3% globally last year. I think it's going to be lower. In fact, the private sector forecasts actually say it's going to be lower this year. And that's without even knowing how the whole Brexit thing may or may not play out in the middle of the year. So that's the problem we're seeing. There's basically the Japanification of the global economy.
But there's a difference, and I always keep highlighting this point. There's certain elements. There is the non-performing loan element. But the big, big problem is the difference is that the Japanese local domestic population hold their country's debt that has been utilized to bail out the same banks. So it's insular. There's a bleed, but it's a bleed within the system. There isn't the open wound. Which America relies on China and all the others not dumping their toys, or the treasuries, more importantly.
Yeah, I mean, you saw within 20 years, the U.S. went from being the world's biggest net creditor to the world's biggest net debtor. So you can imagine, the FOMC policy, which has been spraying dollars into the global economy for many years now, how that's going to have a distortive effect on investment decisions, pricing of capital. I mean, again, in a broader sense, I can see how price discovery has been destroyed in many asset classes. I get asked every day virtually as to why something's going up and why something's going down. And quite often I have no idea. This is me being very honest. They obviously want me to come up with a story, or rather they'll see a move and then ex post you'll come up with a story as to why it happened. But quite often some of these moves are just really weird. I'm talking primarily about cash equity here. But these markets are so thin, there's no real facilitation, it's all algo-driven, it's a random walk half the time. But these prices are supposed to be telling us something. I know for most of your listeners, it'll be a means to generate, positive P&L, which is fantastic. But from an economic perspective, it's basically there to price capital, whether it's fixed income, whether it's equity. And when we tinker around with that mechanism, we undermine the market economy because there isn't the market anymore. So I'm sounding like grumpy old man here, but it's just like, I compare notes with a bunch of traders and we just, what's going on?
I've heard that on certain, that there's complete liquidity dry up in certain debt-based markets.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, back in the day, you'd be trading blocks, and if say an asset manager wanted to sell, $100 million Vodafone, and you go to a market maker, and the market maker says, okay, I can take a third of that order. I'll give you a fixed price on that order, so there's a guaranteed price to the seller on that, and he says, give me the balance to work in the market. And you might have some sort of rinky-dink black box there to tranche it and so on and so forth. But it was largely a manual process, and there was somebody taking risk on and somebody actually taking a view on how much that block was worth and saying, look, I'm going to give you – it's a principal transaction. I take it on my book. I'm going to pay this money. That's fine. Now, all these blocks – block trading basically doesn't exist anymore, except in certain primary transactions. But day-to-day trading – these blocks in equity markets have been vaporized into tiny, tiny little packets. And it's all fed into black boxes and algos and so on and so forth. And so it can be a bit of a, there's not a great bit of visibility as to how these prices are being formed. But I know we're getting onto a different subject, which is basically market microstructure. But I ask yourself the philosophical question. If the buy, because prices are formed by marginal buyer and seller. Yeah, there's this idea it's the average person or the man in the street. It's not, you know, it's highest bid, lowest offer. Yeah, and the market clears at some level. But it's down to marginal pricing. So, you know, quite often the marginal buyer and the marginal seller are high frequency traders who are just supposed to be sort of gaming the rest of the system. So if that's creating the price, well, where does the price come from in the first place? Yeah, it's where does the price come from?
In fact, the whole democratization of investing in markets. At one point, you know, I remember going for a tour of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, and they were saying how it doesn't matter if you're a one lot trader and there's a big guy, you all got to trade to the same system. If your order's in first, you're in front of him. And, you know, if someone wants 1,000, your first has got to be picked off. And I remember how it was also open. And then at some point, during all this process, the large institutions decided that a price discovery mechanism where it was all controlled and on the same platform and the treatment was the same for all didn't suit them. And we started to get concepts like dark pools for equities, make a deal, didn't get reported to the stock exchange, off exchange trades, HFT front running essentially, by which was a crime. That's, I remember a particular stockbroker went to prison for a substantial period, who was front running mutual fund orders that he was being given flow for in SA. And all of a sudden, we now just have electronic versions of what was essentially criminal activity, and it's all okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know,
and we have these off deals where somebody could be buying Barclays in huge job lots between one institution and unloading to another or to some Middle Eastern, and the price discovery mechanism or what deal they do at a knockdown lot rate doesn't get disclosed and is no longer going through an exchange, and all of these principles. Since when did all the skullduggery for the big players come about? Since when was this all allowed? What have all the regulators been doing all this time?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is, I mean, you know, people who are formulating policy, how much practical experience have them of capital markets? I know they, you know, take views and commentary, etc. But at the end of the day, we knew that what the general thrust of the policies, certainly post-financial crisis, was going to be, which was to significantly reduce perceived risk-taking, to make everything you know, central limit order book, also called CLOB, centrally cleared, etc. But the problem is all you're doing is creating sort of an autopilot system, which is, you know, Skynet. I suppose it's Skynet is what kind of what I'm talking about. And, you know, I mean, these days we have, you know, we have these flash crashes and we shrug our shoulders and go, well, you know, that's just the way it happens. And we'll have these investigations, and years later they'll come up with some sort of conclusion, which, you know, probably isn't definitive. But it does worry me that we are in danger of creating a system which is you know, just on autopilot. I don't want to sound sort of apocalyptic about it, but I mean, we are creating a bit of a monster, a bit of a chimera, I'm afraid, in terms of.
Let's go back. Let's take a step back and think about solution and option. Now, there was a fabulous book. It was Reinhardt and Rogoff. It's different this time. And the likes of Paul Krugman, the print and pretend variety, attempted to critique them on their book that was very, very popular, and tried to say, oh, there's a mistake in one of your Excel spreadsheets or whatever the nature was, because I remember there was seemed to be a very high profile media attempt to de-shine what was two very, very credible authors that had written a very seminal book that was getting a little bit too much exposure for the pro system outriders, of which I've mentioned Paul Krugman as one. Anyway, they picked at a I think what amounted to a minor Excel error, which had no bearing on the exclusions, to try deride the entire construct. But if you take Ken Rogoff's shockingly simple advice to people to emerging markets and everything else is just go overweight in gold and underweight in dollars.
Dump
that paper, get your gold. Now, I don't think Gaddafi appreciates that one so much because his vault's full of gold and objective of launching the dinar didn't serve his lifespan particularly high. And then we had that delightful woman, Hillary Rodham Clinton, make the now famous statement, "We came, we saw, he died," comment. And that'll be our, no doubt, our future American president again. But surely someone as that creditworthy as that is saying, look, just get out of the trillions of dollars in the foreign currencies that you hold, because there's this competitive trashing. And in the long run, when things get disorderly, because there's no way, when everyone starts to play for themselves, it's kind of like the pie is shrinking and we're all hungry. And each day they bring the pizza, but the pizza's getting smaller. And so far, everyone's just taking their slice and then eating and then watching while the others get their slice and eat while they get hungry again. And so far, we've managed to maintain order. But as that pizza gets smaller and people are working harder for less and feeling hungrier, and the slices are getting smaller, when does the breaking of ranks, the cheating, the scraping, the not cutting so straight and nipping a little piece of somebody else's slice till an outright brawl break out? And at that point, surely gold's going to be the hideout place.
Well, quite possibly. I mean, I think in terms of when it's going to degenerate into an outright brawl, I mean, I can quite easily see that happening by the summer. As I said, I think the quid pro quo for the Fed going easy in the Shanghai consensus was real reform by some of the other parties, notably China and Japan, and it hasn't really happened. And in terms of China, it's been absolutely blatant that they're just going for growth. They're prioritizing growth over reform, and they're devaluing the currency. So everything that they're not supposed to be doing, they are plowing on ahead. And I think that, you know, that we are going to see the Fed react. I think we should see the Fed.
I love the way, because China speak a different language, they seem a different type of person from a different side of the planet. We're always so unequivocal. Whenever I listen to US commentators on China, every single stat's a complete lie and all of this, and every single action, and they come currency manipulators and they this and that. It always seems so easy for us to unload on the complete, and I've no doubt that there's validity to them, but it always seems we don't seem to recognize the same traits in ourselves with the same robustness and unequivocal nature.
Well, it's interesting because in terms of currency manipulation and reneging on deals, I'm always reminded about the Plaza Accord, which is over 30 years ago now, which is said, well, that was a good example. You know, it's a prime example of central banks coming together and or finance ministers coming together, and it basically agreed to get the dollar down. And when they got the dollar down, big time, you know, almost 50% reduction in the dollar. But the thing is what the US was supposed to do in return for basically a massive competitive devaluation was to cut its budget deficit. And of course, under Reaganomics, it didn't do anything of the sort. So it had a hyper-competitive dollar. It continued to spend, which of course meant you had very healthy GDP growth in the latter 1980s. And that ultimately, on the flip side, set us up for an asset price boom and bust in Japanese economy, from which it never recovered. So I think I do recognize the fact that the West is absolutely not blameless in reneging.
Oh, God, Nixon and the gold standard and closing the gold window and then doing so on its own citizens and all of that, and manipulation of stats and restatements of non-farm results post the event when they needed a big number and all sorts of nonsense. I mean, I think they're all at it. And the notion that someone further away suspect the worst, you'll be shocked what's going on under your own kitchen sink if you ever stop to have a look. And just a moot comment. I suppose if they were Jewish or they were black, there would be howls of anti-Semitism, given the current news flow that we've had. It seems a theme, or racism. But it just seems like we can get away with calling them all and sundry and not recognizing the same crimes in ourselves. And I think it's just become a habit. Anyway, it's a moot point, but I think we're all cheating, aren't we? In some way.
I couldn't possibly comment. I suspect if I were cheating, Francis, I'd be doing rather better than I am at the moment.
Because, oh, God, no, but I don't mean that in that kind of cheating. Oh. We're not getting saucy just yet. No. As a single man, I think it's difficult to be cheating at this point in time by virtue of desperation. But I'm just saying, the whole scope of economics and the accounting, generally accepted accounting practices, you know, so many of those principles have been given up. I mean, this is the game has just become a fast and loose game. I mean, buybacks on debt, loading a company with debt and pumping the share price up short term.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a whole field of financial engineering, isn't there? That's grown up. There was one, there was a book, Terry Smith, I think it was, called Accounting for Growth, which supposedly, I don't know if this is an apocryphal story, got him sacked from, I think it was UBS at the time, but it was like he'd blown the whistle on all the professionalists in the city, saying, well, this is how the companies that we analyze, this is how they fiddle their numbers. And it was like, wow, you've actually, you know, you've blown the whistle. You're not supposed to give away these secrets. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if you look at, say, US numbers, I mean, they're obliged to.
He's a lucky man. He did it in the 90s and 80s. He could have been suicided for that.
Well, that kind of forensic thing I find fascinating anyway, because you know that whenever they bring in a new rule, another loophole is created, and I've been looking at accounts for long enough now. I know what one tip I would give, sort of anecdotally, if somebody's looking at a company report, is to read it back to front and read the notes to the accounts first, which is probably
when you're freshest.
Dirt is buried. That way, when you look at the numbers, you know what you're actually looking at. So read it backwards is my advice.
Very, very good comment that, because the devil's in the details of what gets included and excluded or recategorized.
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, you know, they'll never make it the stuff they don't want you to know, they'll never make it easy for you to find. You can be fairly sure of that, and that's true. I think that was a Yes Minister episode once, Sir Humphrey burying some documentation for Jim Hacker. But yes, it was it's fascinating. But the thing is, you see, the vast majority of the public view on the market is through the media prism, and the media equally are unfortunately quite susceptible to manipulation by other people with very strong vested interests.
I just find most people repeat and very few do research.
Yeah,
it's almost like there's actually one person who does work, and then there's a hall of mirrors, and the image gets projected across all images, and that person will do it with a particular objective in mind, but will not want it to be overtly aware that that objective is in mind. And then there's just a system of repeaters. It's like loud hailers on poles throughout the countryside that'll just echo, but will echo on the basis that they are independent thinkers of their own right, and that it's a valid source, etc., etc. And everything seems to be taken and just repeated. And it's more about the transmission of the concept rather than the critical thinking as to what's contained in it, and whether it's been well researched or correctly done.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if analysts actually did their job, then financial reporters merely being financial reporters wouldn't be a bad thing. The problem is that the analysts and so forth feeding into the media, a lot of them, probably going to do myself no favors here, but a lot of them lack critical thought. And you'd have to say that most of them have an axe to grind. I mean, asset managers are there to manage assets and generate a management fee on the back of that. Investment banks are out there to do deals. One way.
A totally captured system. And the only people who are the marks are us.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, this is the problem. I mean, what you've also got to understand, I think we touched upon this in the Ingram Chronicles, was that the resting state of market commentary is bullish. It's default bullish. And that accounts for 90% of the commentary out there. It's bullish, bullish, bullish. We see a market dip, it's buy on the dip. It's a buying opportunity. Average down, blah, blah,
absolutely,
blah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And yep, the problem is that the bearish case tends to be distorted because you've got a few people out there, not many of them, but a few people out there who are perma bears. You know, so you'll have the, you know, the Mark Farbers and the Nouriel Roubinis and the Albert Edwards, Sock Jed, and so forth, and you know, who've been bearish forever, you know, even missed years of market ups and downs, you know. And I try to be pragmatic about it, and I recognize that the market goes up and market goes down. I mean, I can look at the history. I say, well, obviously there are times when the market's bullish and the market's bearish. And even if I think the fundamentals, and I look at fundamentals, and I'm thinking, well, the fundamentals aren't good, but you know, the chicken doesn't know its head's being cut off yet, so the market's going to continue to run. But in my judgment, the risk outweighed the reward by the end of the first quarter of last year. Yeah, so it wasn't. Yeah, I'll put my hand up. Not exact timing, but you know, in the broad scheme of things, I just felt that things were starting to fall apart. And in terms of, you know, the broad macroeconomic backdrop and the sort of politics behind that, and how that seems to be playing out, I'm more bearish than ever on this. You know, I just don't see what we're on.
And could you be wrong? Let's challenge the bearish argument. What if the debt markets, to me, we've had one of the longest Sunday sessions. Tonight, one of the quantifying, one of the psychology, emotion, many consecutive sides, and I brought up the chart just to show the cost of trying to pick bottoms, and one of those charts was the bond market. And I showed from literally the early 80s, the peak yield under Falker, and then the subsequent bull market that has extended ever since. And you've got from 82 all the way to today. So you've got 18 years of the millennials, and you've got another 16 to add on to that. So you're talking well through the 30-year mark, just for the one half. That's peak to a trough, we're assuming, if it's trough now,
yeah,
of what's that? It's 34 years. That's one half of the cycle since the last time, since back in the 30s. That is the keep on keeping on. Now, surely at these levels, we've now reached a floor with bonds that they can go no further significantly up. Now, many have said that only to find them tweak it a little further. But surely now, the upside on owning bonds versus the long run loss in potential loss in value is so vast that you're risking 10 or 30 to gain one. And that one you better take real quick if it's in terms of a sort of long run risk reward. And pensions and portfolio theory always has a high percent, up to 30% of bond allocations in it, and a mix of them, corporate, government being the pick, government being, you know, from my MBA days, the risk-free trade, the calculating weighted average cost of capital, that was your treasury 10-year bill. You know, that was your hurdle rate for analyzing any business opportunity. How much does it pay extra over that you could get risk-free? Yeah. And the risk-free rate was your 10-year US treasury bill. That was the interest rate. So you didn't do a business plan if it only gave 6% and the T-bill was paying 5%, because the extra risk for that 1% of having a small business that can fail on something that theoretically could never fail, and I put that all in inverted commas with a big question mark afterwards, that just seems to hold anymore. So surely we're at a bond all-time low. That doesn't mean it's about to reverse and collapse, the timing-wise. But surely we should be buying into short bond funds. maybe even multiple leveraged ones, two-buy bond funds as part of our portfolio. One of the things I want to come out of our discussions together is, what does a guy do? He can listen to us talk.
Yeah.
And he can get a better understanding of all the machinations. And that's one of the reasons I bring in Rogoff and gold. If he's saying emerging market economies, just dump your paper, get into gold. And I think the same goes, he's commenting obviously at a bigger level, but at the same value applies to your retail man. What about those that have to buy some paper? What paper do they buy? Many will say you can't have 100% portfolio precious metals. Even if you're right, yes, it'll be great, but you're just too diverse. What if there's a little slip and it doesn't turn out that way? What if there's confiscation, whatever, any of the many things that could be, even though there's certainly things you could potentially cover against confiscation. What if you don't want your entire wealth in a trunk under your bed or in the ceiling, whatever the case, maybe dug in the back garden. And surely putting some money and finding a leveraged short bond fund that you just chuck away, 100 quid a month or 400, whatever your threshold is, and you chuck it into a super short bond, a long run tracker, and you just keep throwing that baby in there and you play the long game, and it doesn't matter if it goes down and that 100 quid's worth 50, you keep chucking it in and you keep chucking it in, and you say, I've got 30 years till I turn 65, 25 years till I turn whatever, 80, wherever you are. You just feed that super short fund in there. You buy yourself some gold and silver equities, or you buy a tracker on the gold index, the HUI, for example, on the US, and you just hold that trade. Because where can bonds go from here?
Yeah.
Especially after we just said, if they go negative, it's our suspicion they're going to kill the banks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, going back right to the very start of our conversation, what the market's pricing, as I say, is the Fed is maybe one rate rise this year. But, you know, even that seems to be fading away. So if the market is pricing is correct, then you'd say that kind of bond capitulation may be some way off. If I'm right about interest rates, and I think, as I say, the Fed has held off hoping that other parties, shall we say, will start to coordinate. But, you know, I don't think the Fed's patience is unlimited. And I also think that, you know, seeing that there is a certain amount of inflation building up in the domestic economy, they shouldn't fundamentally anyway be holding back indefinitely. So I think the Fed is the market is underpricing what the Fed should be doing this year. And if I'm right, then yeah, that's a trade for this year. And there may be political overtones. This obviously got presidential election, and goodness knows what coming up. So, you know, I know there are historic studies saying, well, you know, it doesn't really matter, but I'm pretty sure that it'll be a consideration where we are in the electoral cycle. One thing I am fairly sure about is that we're seeing volatility in most risk asset markets being significantly underpriced. You're seeing it in FX markets. You're not really seeing it anywhere else. And I fail
to give us that again, because for many laymen, Mike, volatility measures, are you talking VIX, etc.? What asset classes?
Yeah.
What does it mean? Spell it out for the man in the street who's listening to this and thinks you're saying something important but doesn't get it.
Right. So in the option market, so for instance, you can buy a call, so the right but not obligation to buy something, or a put the right
The derivatives.
So basically, it's a measure of the variation in the price, the volatility in the price, and the price that you're paying to capture that upside or downside move is ultimately, it's what you call implied volatility. If you think the things are going to be volatile going forward, then you're going to be willing to pay a higher premium. To order to have an economic interest, shall we say, in that volatility going forward. And what we've seen in FX markets is we've seen heightened implied volatility. People are willing to pay quite a lot. Think of it in terms of an insurance premium, for instance.
Yeah. But in other words, it's a supply and demand market like anything else. And if lots of people are all suddenly wanting insurance, which is basically, by the way, all the terminology from options comes from the insurance industry, hence premium and strike. So as people are looking for insurance in the derivative markets, they're paying more. Even though the underlying volatility at the moment doesn't justify that pricing, the implied volatility of people's desire through demand for these products is pricing in a lot higher.
Exactly. So from what I can see, you've got a situation where FX implied vol is high, and that implies a high degree of macroeconomic dislocation.
And that would also be the institutions.
Yes.
That's the key point, because the people that take derivatives on foreign exchange is not the man in the street, and it's okay that it be known, because the retail guy doesn't know this.
Exactly. So it's a professional market to a very high degree. Now, what I'm saying is despite this apparent degree of macroeconomic dislocation, which is should we say, baked into the
FX. I think you were saying the FX market is having quite a high vol.
Yes.
Which is the institutional, and you want to compare it to other markets that are not reflecting the similar degree of vol.
Exactly.
Which ones are those? Equities?
Well, they're generally cash equity markets. So VIX, V2X, which is on the Eurostoxx 50. It had a bit of a spike today, as you can imagine, but I was looking at
that. Euro had its round turn, 100 pip rally into the 116s and then chucked it back down. By the way, on that note for all the listeners, I've said many times, and I get lots of queries, on the Euro-USD, we suspect continuation. What is HVF theory? Sorry, Mike, minor sidebar. Lots of queries coming through on this. We expect continuation unless a level is run. That level is the 117.20. And yes, this has pulled high and it's ground for a long period, but it's not really been super high momentum. This last spell has, but in terms of a daily and weekly chart. And this was potentially a key reversal day today on the euro. However, it's very close to that 117.20. And if it goes the remaining distance, then it's now in reversal category. But the law is we assume continuation until it unwinds. So, sorry, you were just alluding on that. We had vols today, but broadly the euro 500, or was it the 50 you said, low vol compared to the FX?
50. Yeah, the Eurostoxx 50. So VIX, S&P 500, V2X, which is Eurostoxx 50, the MOVE index, which is a proprietary index by Merrill's, which is on the US Treasury volatility across the whole curve, and you've got various commodity indices, composite indices like Jefferies, and I think Goldman Sachs published one. All of those are very low on implied vol. So for me, one of the interesting things is you've got, FX, it's way up there, and everything else is down below. And I'm thinking,
Could it just be that because FX is the god market, the biggest of them all, and it's so central bank whim driven at the moment? I mean, we started this discussion saying they tried to have us believe they were going to do four rate hikes, and they came in even more bullish into January, and by the beginning of March, not 2 months later, they had already cut that by 50%. So they were up on four, they were charging bull for four and biasing to the upside, and by 2 months later, they'd actually cut it in half. That the unpredictability and flip-flopping nature is such, and specific to the central bankers and the FX, that those other markets do not face, even though central banker comments clearly will affect equities and other markets as well. Is there an argument, is what I'm saying, that there is a justification that there's not the same degree of volatility risk in the others? I don't believe so, but we have to ask the question.
Well, you just argued it, and there's no way I can say you can't argue that. But what I would say is that, if central bank policy guidance, rhetoric, whatever you want to occur, is so uncertain, what does that tell you about the state of the real economy?
That it's poor, but the state of the economy has nothing to do as to whether the market goes up or down. I mean, the state of the common economy has been poor since 2009, and the market's gone up 4.5 times if you're trading the NASDAQ.
And of course, we've had plenty of phases in markets where, bad news equals good news. Or the macro is awful. Interest rates are going to stay low. fill your boots with equities. Yeah, that's happened before.
So can we have that justification? What I was going to say is we don't want to be Uber bears just for the sake of bears on equities. What I was going to say is, if the debt market, and I never finished making this case because I went into such a long ramble about the trend of bonds, but if the debt market is the one that dies and is the true bubble of all bubbles, surely, regardless of valuations, whether good value or not at the moment, all the money goes to equity because the other stuff could go to zero.
It's possible. I mean, the problem is we haven't really been in this situation before.
Well, it could be the case of the lesser evil. You could be in a situation where the debt is so bad and it has such weak prospects for so many decades.
Yeah.
If not having an outright fail, well, why not just have an overvalued equity that'll pay you 2% dividend, which is more than your bond?
Yeah, or I was going to say, Francis, was that, you know, the Japanese equity market had been in this situation for many, many years. Yeah, I mean, it would be trading at 40, 50, 60 times earnings, and nobody would bat an eyelid. Well,
what happened is the Japanese citizens kept buying their government debt, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, that's the difference. The Japanese citizens have kept buying their government debt.
Yeah, it was a captive market to an extent.
Yeah, and that what you're not going to necessarily have coordinated, you would need a globalized version of coordinated behavior, similar to that of Japan, where all of us took our share of responsibility for continuing to consume the rate of debt that America is still generating to save the dollar.
Which brings us back to the Shanghai Consensus, and I would have to say precious little sign of that so far. I mean, one of the things that should have come out of it, and we were discussing when we offline, the move by the US Treasury to effectively put a number of currencies or a number of countries on warning for possible currency manipulation, and that list included China, Japan, Germany, and Taiwan. And one of the things that, you know, for instance, Germany was supposed to be doing, and this is something the IMF has pressed them for, and it's something they've talked about doing but not actually done, is to actually run a bigger budget deficit, for instance. Actually run a budget deficit, because they're not running a budget deficit anymore, in order to expand domestic demand and make them less export dependent, or help out the periphery in Europe and sort of that. They're not doing any of that, any more than China is reforming, any more than Abe is getting close to firing a third arrow. Yeah, so, I mean, again, we're just wholly reliant on these central banks, and many of them are tailgating on the Fed. But the, you know, we're not in a unipolar global economy. We probably haven't, probably have never been.
I don't think you would get on board the for everyone who talks of comparing the situation. There are certain aspects that are comparable to Japan, where the whole of the Western world, and including China, in fact, globally, is. With the debt situation. But I don't think we have the same set of circumstances where you have one captive provider of debt and one captive audience buyer of that debt who are prodigious savers.
Yes.
So, you know, let's get this straight. So you have an aging Japanese population who are prodigious savers, who consistently spend well less than what they earn. In other words, they are disposable income rich, and they are non-consumerist. It just simply doesn't carry over to the average Westerner, who is over-leveraged, buys his car on HP, buys his furniture on HP, has a credit card balance that he's rotating, running into the tens of thousands, and all of them. I just don't see it transferring. There are many differences, and this is where I differ from the likes of Kyle Bass. And this is why all these people that were telling us all a long time ago, and I said, the yen will top out, I believe it. And they were going at 300, the trade of the next 3 decades. We're going USD JPY to 300. And to me, I don't see the Japanese as being as bad. Everyone repeats ad nauseum, oh, then the Japanese in deflation and multi lost decades.
Yeah.
Lost decades where their currency was stronger than everybody else. How terrible for them when they wanted to go on holiday. How terrible for them when they need to buy a European handbag, an American PlayStation. You know what I'm saying? So I think if we're trying to condense this down, is it possible that equities could be the least bad class and actually gets even further than we even imagine in terms of overvaluation, as the size of the bond market is so huge that even small amounts trickling out. Let's remember, you know, the Japanese kept buying and still save and keep buying their government's debt. China is no longer adding to its total of American debt. It's sat there with a $1.1 trillion. It's actually slightly, it's mucked around with its portfolio. It's actually divested slightly from its portfolio. So the Fed is the biggest holder. That's what many people forget. The Fed now is the buyer of last resort of their own debt. So you're talking the Ponzi scheme is completely concluded. You know, the left hand is paying the right hand, which is giving the money to the left hand to pay the right hand. The circle is done. There's far less links in between now. The others are refusing to take it. Well, so they've become the buyer of the last resort. We are in surely the end game of this whole debt cycle thing. And they can keep putting it on. They are leveraged now. And, you know, the likes of you that like to swing by a zero hedge or whatever the likes are, approaching 80 to 1 on their balance sheet, the Fed, in terms of what capital they have and what their holdings are. So, I mean, it's incredible. And no one else is going to stand in and buy that debt. Everyone else is creating too much of their own.
Well, they can create their own. They can create. I mean, central banks are unique in that they create their own liquidity. Yeah. So, but the nuclear option actually on central bank held debt is simply to cancel it. It's simply to cancel it because there's always this idea that at some point, because of the Fed's, even though you know obviously we've tapered, there's no increase in QE, it's still reinvesting the proceeds as they mature. But it's basically to say, oh, well, we're going to cancel, because ultimately, you know, the central bank's part of the public sector. It's public sector debt. Effectively, this is debt that we owe to ourselves. Yeah. I mean, people's brains can melt down at this particular point in time. But the bottom line is that you could theoretically cancel the debt to yourself.
Or gild that $5 trillion coin in plated in platinum.
You could do, but I mean, what it would mean is a massive and permanent increase in base money, and that potentially could trigger hyperinflation. We could go from low.
We'll never get there. We can't ever get to hyperinflation because the minute the rates go beyond a certain point, you know, everyone's been chucked out of their homes. We've discussed this already. We can only go to stagflation the minute it goes anywhere, and a small amount of change in interest rates, and you're going to see an absolute drying up of all consumer activity from homeowners all over the planet, America, Europe, Britain, and emerging markets, etc. Everyone with a loan. We can't hyperinflate. It'll be over in a second.
Well, it really depends if the consumer loses complete faith in the currency, yeah. Because I mean, you know, there is historic precedent of this. I mean, you know, I always go back to, you know, the Weimar Republic, and so forth. I mean, that went within 12 months from outright deflation to hyperinflation. So you know, and obviously,
and then it ends as quickly. It ends as quickly.
Exactly. Well, yeah,
it ends as quickly. So there's no sustained period of hyperinflation because the debt is so huge and barely affordable at its low rates. The hyperinflation means double and even triple digits, and going on to even more, quadruple, four, five, six digits type inflation. The problem is we don't need a double digit. Stagflation means typical interest rates in a normal interest rate environment and stubborn low growth.
Yeah.
So stagflation is what we'll get. We'll get the, you know, if we went to 5% now.
Yeah.
It's over.
I think one thing we can, I think, certainly agree on is that the outlook on, you know, a 6-month, 12-month, 2-year view is not what we've all been told to expect pretty much every year post-crisis. So, you know, where are we 7 years now?
So put your conspiracy tinfoil hat on. You're running the cabal of central bankers. You're head of the Fed, and you've got all these others that have dug themselves into this hole around you, and you're coordinating this farm factory, this ant farm. And you're sitting there, and you think, how do we end this? If we all just call a great bad debt moratorium and write it all off and say those bonds that we've issued are all worthless, they won't ever do that. That's too honest. There'll be a sleight of hand. There'll be a new tool created, a rebranding exercise, or they'll go into a whole-fledged, full-scale war. How do you see, what do you think they're going to do to mask the reset? How does it play out? What are the options?
Was any number of options. I mean, one of the options I think we touched on last time was the total digitalization of cash and the extension of a lower bound via negative rates into cash itself, which forces people basically to
consume
money forces money into the banking system, and it forces it to depreciate at the same time. So it gets the
it's the ursary extractor's bail-in. By sleight of hand and by small degree, but with consistency and time frame on its side.
Yeah.
The compound interest man's slight theft. Yeah, well, there's plenty of mechanisms for that. What about the usefulness of inflation and the tax bracket creep and things like that? They need some inflation as well, won't they? Or will they just go full-blown war machine?
The war.
And full-blown war somewhere, and in the cloud of dust that we're all distracted by, and the emotions of the carnage, we end up with a Bretton Woods post-event something fresh.
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, you know, the economic issues which we've had to deal with both, you know, immediately pre and, of course, post-crisis – has created a lot of voter disenchantment, disengagement, a lot of anger, and the longer that
How angry those Greeks are. Imagine a couple of billion of them instead of just a few million.
Well, I'm having lunch
in China.
He's going to tell me all about it, but from one of the big banks. But yeah, I mean that's a farce. Yeah, that's a farce. I mean, Greece is. For me, Greece is just the canary in the coal mine as far as the Eurozone project's concerned. I mean, Greece is now just a debtor's prison manned by German guards, is effectively where it is. So forget about democracy. You know, forget about it. There's elections are just something they organize every few years.
to maintain the facade of choice.
Yes. Exactly.
Because the real leader who wanted to set his people free from this didn't wear a tie and rode in on a motorbike. And that was a bit too nonconformist and individualistic for the powers that be.
I mean, it's that pantomimes, you know, continues. It's one of the things that I think might trigger a Brexit. I mean, as I think I mentioned last time around, if I were the Greek pre-em, I'd want to trigger a crisis ahead of the UK vote, because that would generate leverage with Germany and
But I think they've been too schooled and crushed. I think they literally have the inspectors sitting at their desk at work, EU-funded inspectors, because they were far more bold, and now even the news flow and what's getting said. Either that, or there's a media silence.
Well, that's
which is also quite possible. A lot of angry people at one point, and we were hearing a lot about it. And now, it just seems like the dog's been muzzled.
Yeah. I'll let you know how my lunch goes tomorrow. I'm going to be asking a lot of searching questions as to what's actually going on.
That's a fascinating future podcast, Mike. I look forward to that. We'll come back to the Eurozone and do that. I think we're going to wrap here. We've got a great little 3-4-parter for the people to enjoy in the bag. Mike, any passing comments for your listeners in terms of what to do and how to do and what's going to be interesting? What to watch for in the week ahead?
I think the trade for the next few months is just to go long vol going into the summer. I don't think we're going to get through June, July without a major volatility event
Does a layman who doesn't understand how to get long vol, how does a retail trader, how would a guy who has a Spreadbet account go in and go long vol?
Oh, I believe, I mean, I'm not going to quote it offhand, but there are exchange traded funds, which are...
So you look for an exchange traded fund volatility. Do you look for a VIX index or...
VIX index. I mean, you know, you can, something which is tradable, go long of VIX. And obviously if volatility spikes, the VIX will go...
And they like it when we're on holiday for all the bad news, because people are less relaxed, more relaxed, and they're away from their desk and they just go, whatever, it's on holiday, I'll deal with it all when I get back home.
Yeah, but of course that means that, you know, fewer participants in the market.
Gaps. Lots of thinner trade. Up,
and even in the absence of any particular event risk, markets tend to be a little bit more volatile anyway, certainly intraday. So, you know, that's why... volatility in the summer can be particularly problematic, and like, as I said, there's a plenty of event risk out there over the June-July period to roll markets. So, I mean, that's certainly what I'm looking at. But other than that, I mean, I think really, as somebody who's more of an equity person, I'm looking to see how the earnings season's unfolding.
British banks.
Sorry,
what's your take on the British banks?
Oh, train wreck, basically. But I mean,
more downside to come.
I just think people have just massively underestimated the problems that the whole business model has. I wouldn't even single out UK banks. I think US banks are in a relatively strong position, but you know they're facing the same secular forces. I think fintech is in danger of eating their lunch. It's interesting just to throw a couple of stats out. I mean, the return on equity, as I think I said last year, European banks is 4.5%. They're trading at 0.6 times book. Yeah. What does that tell you about the market's outlook for their profitability and the reaction to lower than expected revenues? Always the cut costs. But the problem is they're cutting into muscle and bone now. And all the time they're asking, you know, to be layered on more costs because of, you know, regulation, etc. So, yeah, it's kind of long story short, you know, doesn't surprise me at all that, you know, that European banking, as I said, peaked in October 2009. And we've had so many false dawns. All the analysts have been saying, you know, it's their value. To my mind, in aggregate, I don't want to single any particular bank out for various reasons, but I think as a sector as a whole is a value trap. It's a value trap. And I think on the flip side of that, you know,
beware that cheap, it may get cheaper still.
Not exactly. It's, you know, it's all very well to be cheap, but the question is it cheap for a reason? You could look at price book, but the thing is, looking at some of these metrics in isolation is often meaningless. So saying, oh, it's trading below book value, then great. But the question is what kind of return on that book value, i.e. what return on equity are you actually going to generate? And as I've indicated, mid-single digits. That's the reason they're trading where they are. And in certain countries, Italy, I think within Europe being the obvious example this year, there are questions about not only the return on the book value, but the book value itself. You know, the quality of the loans, the level of non-performing loans, etc. So, and of course, banks are inherently leveraged. Yeah, so you only have to be slightly wrong on some of these numbers, and the value to an equity investor.
They'll all be motivated, given all the tests the central bank is to be doing, is to putting their shiniest face forward and hiding any amount of sins. So this is as good as it gets in terms of reflection on numbers, in my view as well. Yes, excellent. Mike. Yes. Mike Ingram, thank you very much for that. So a shout out on vols for you, either to get an ETF or possibly, by the way, this show is purely for entertainment. This is not constituting in any advice of any form on any side. Neither of us have an incentive or a position, nor are we cleared as advisors. Mike Ingram, thank you very much for an awesome hour and a bit here, and I'm looking forward to breaking this up and getting this out to readers and getting and our listeners getting the feedback on them. The chart that you have all been seeing that it was shared was the Euro USD. Did we turn? We'll have to address this. Did we turn at the one 116 level today, now trading 114.97. Back down through not just the 16 level, not just the 15 level, but back in the 114s. Did the Euro USD just exhaust? That we'll have to touch on next week. Mike, thanks a million. Have a great evening.
Cheers, Francis. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Take care.